Hi, and welcome to our bite-sized payments regulation podcast, our first. My name is Paul Tamala, and I work at Finastra, a large financial services fintech. I work in the payments industry and with our payments regulators. Just a little introduction to me. I started working in payroll and payments in the mid-80s, and I've kept coming back to it over the last, 25, 35 years. I focused on payment solutions, our industry, and now specifically regulation. I've also worked on the building of the NPA. I sat on the UK PSR Advisory Board, on the Nexo Standards Board. I'm a member of the SEPS ECRI Executive Committee, which is a think tank based out of Belgium. So I am pretty much focused in and around payments. I'm also joined by Monica Monaco, the owner and managing director of Trusted EU Affairs. Trusted EU Affairs is a regulatory affairs consultancy specializing in financial services in the European, at the European level. Monica, can you give us a quick introduction?
Sure, Paul, thank you. My name is Monica Monaco. I am the owner and managing director of Trust EU Affairs. I founded Trust EU Affairs in 2013. I take care for my clients of the relations with the European Commission, the Parliament and the Council, and we analyze regulation. I specialize on European regulations about payments and financial services more generally. And so I'm very interested in trying to discuss in more details what payments regulation is about.
Okay, so why have we started this podcast? Well, you know, our aim is to give you a 20-minute bite-sized update of what's happening in the payments regulatory world, and just to give you the key salient points so you can keep up to speed. While our industry has always had regulation and it's always had controls, the rate of change has increased massively, and I think it's only going to continue changing, and probably I think it will change faster and probably more deeply. However, with that comes increased documentation, and there is absolutely loads of it. And I do mean loads of it. There's the just so many documents to read. And especially when you look across the world where regulators do not plan their changes together. They're looking after their country or their region. And so the changes that they're putting in place are, of course, not actually synchronized. And we also have acronyms, new acronyms. We have PISPs, we have ASPs, we have DORA. Oh boy, do we have our own acronyms. But this often means that it's hard to understand what's going on. And the documents often defend themselves from being read by their sheer size, to quote Churchill. But have no fear. We are here to help guide you through all of the complexity. Monica, can you comment on just the sheer scale of the documentation that we see just within the EU?
Oh, well, Paul, yes, I completely agree. I mean, we have a lot of documents to read. They are very complex, very long. I can give you some examples. If we start with the PSD2, for example, so already the name of PSD2 is normally Directive 2015-2366, which is already not very familiar for a lot of people. And secondly, the document is over 90 pages long, 117 articles, and that's only the PSD2. Then if we go into what happens after the PSD2, then we're discussing the revision of the PSD2. And so there was a European Commission consultation on the review of the PSD2, which closed on the 5th of July. Now, the consultation document itself contains 56 questions, and it adds up to 125 pages. That's just the questions. Then industry is asked to provide answers. Even more interestingly, in this consultation, a number of institutions also participated, typically the European Banking Authority, that was providing its own input into the targeted consultation on the revision of the PSD2. So the opinion of the European Banking Authority has as a title the following: Opinion of the European Banking Authority on its technical advice on the review of the PSD2. And this was published on the 23rd of June and amounts to 115 pages. That's just the opinion of the EBA about what the European Commission should put in PSD3. And of course, once we will have PSD3, there will be many versions of the PSD3, depending on the stage of the PSD3 in the legislative proposal. So we will I personally think I will be reading at least 20 to 40 different versions of the PSD3 when this will be out, as was the case on the PSD2 at the time. So indeed, a lot of lengthy documents with most of the time obscure names.
Indeed. And so we're here to help. But, you know, so it's not only the size, though, it's also the context of the previous works of art. And often they build upon other regulations and other pieces of work that have happened in the past. So just reading the current proposed regulation, albeit with the scale that Monica's just outlined, will only get you so far unless you understand the previous ones. And typically they build upon each other, again, making it hard to get up to speed. And I have to say, Monica, these documents are written with a very, very specific style and language.
Yes, this is very true, Paul. You know, this is applicable law, and so the documents need to be very precise. Also, the definitions are always taken from previous directives or regulations for having what is called legal coherence between the different documents. So sometimes definitions would not necessarily look very logical at the first look. They are there because they ensure consistency with the previous regulations on the same matter. Mm-hmm. And of course, the style and language is very specific. There are the recitals before even the articles that kind of give you an interpretation of what the regulator wants to say with the articles of the directive or the regulation. And all this needs some specific skills and a lot of time to be understood and put in practice properly. But there is also a third factor here, which is timing. So there is always a timeline to comply with regulation, of course, once this is applicable. And this can vary between 12 and 24 months, depending on what the regulator decides on each regulation or directive. But there is also then a specific European legislative procedure, which also includes several stages. At each stage, we will have a new version of the document. So indeed, the process is quite complex, I would say.
Yeah, I think it is complex, yes. But, well, look, you know, it's also fair to say that there are at least three stages of life of this regulatory file, and the regulatory file being the work as it goes through these phases. There is an initial consultancy phase where a paper is proposed and feedback sought from the interested parties, and there'll be a lot of interested parties. There's clearly a lot of activity, stroke lobbying on the proposal and its contents and what type of service product should be in scope of the proposal. And at this stage, it has the widest scope. And, you know, this may be a maximum of, you know, 6 months. It could go even longer. But, you know, there are more phases of this.
Yes, indeed. And you know, as a result of the consultation process that you just described, and also as a result of some other technical assessments or studies that the European Commission may decide to do directly or commission to external entities, there will be a draft legislative proposal. Now, once we have the draft legislative proposal, which is published, then the legislative procedure will start. And the length of the legislative procedure is on average of 18 months. I say on average because there are cases where the legislative procedure went on for more than 2 years, typically on the GDPR, on the General Data Protection Regulation, because there were an enormous number of amendments in the parliament, and also the council was not, let's say, very quick in agreeing on the position due to the technicalities, but also the political relevance of the proposal. But the normal legislative procedure will normally have a length of, on average, 18 months. So what happens, how it is the legislative procedure composed? Well, the European Commission will submit a proposal to the Council and to the European Parliament. The Council and the Parliament will then adopt a legislative proposal either at the first reading or at the second reading. And if the two institutions do not reach an agreement after the second reading, then there will be a conciliation committee which is convened. This is called co-decision procedure, and this was firstly introduced in 1992 and was then extended in use in 1999, when we saw really a further important role of the parliament in the procedure. Then with the adoption of the Lisbon Treaty, the co-decision was renamed as ordinary legislative procedure and became the main decision-making procedure used for adopting EU legislation. And this applies to around 85 policy areas. So indeed, there is a lot of exchange between the institutions, the three institutions, the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament, that goes on during these 18 months.
Wow. So, of course, now the European Commission publishes a draft regulation. And so now the scope is very much more specific, and all the interested stakeholders and the scope, they within the scope, they start looking at the draft law in text in much more detail and discuss and start to discuss the relevant provisions within other European institutions too. So the Council of the Union and, of course, the European Parliament itself.
Yes, indeed, indeed. This is exactly how it works. And, you know, on this, maybe it's also interesting for our audience to explain who can start, who can initiate EU legal acts. What is the right of initiative? So normally it's the Commission, as we just explained, which is the only EU institutions that has the power to initiate EU legal acts. So the Commission, as we said, will submit proposals on its own initiative or at the request of other institutions. But also the Council may, at a simple majority, request the Commission to carry out studies and submit any appropriate legislative proposal. The Parliament also, by a majority of its component members, may also ask the Commission to submit legislative proposals. And there are also specific cases that are defined in the treaties where the ordinary legislative procedure can also be launched, for example, by a quarter of the member states or by a recommendation from the European Central Bank or at the request of the Court of Justice. So again, in terms of length of the process, we are talking about 18 months for the legislative procedure, then 12 or 24 months for the European legislative procedure to proposal to become applicable. And so from the moment in which the new European regulation is envisaged and published by the Commission, and the moment in which this becomes applicable and applicable law, sometimes we have over 4 years that may have passed.
Wow. So the point of this podcast is to try and consolidate all of the points we've just made and trying to make it easier to consume and to put it into context, i.e. what's going on? Where are we in the process? So we intend to get this podcast out on a regular basis and give you the bite-sized chunks of what is going on inside of the regulatory world. Hopefully, bite-sized pieces of regulatory news that you can use rather than having to go through all those documents yourselves. However, before I go on, I want to clarify a few things. We often talk about regulation and directives, but what's the difference?
Okay, so this is not a very difficult difference to explain. I'll try to explain here the difference between a regulation and a directive. So the regulation has a binding legal force throughout every member state and enters into force on a set date in all member states. So all the 27 member states will have the regulation entering into force exactly on the same date. The directives, though, lay down certain results that must be achieved, but each member state, so each of the 27 member states, is free to decide how to transpose directives into national law. So basically, the difference is the following. A regulation is a binding legislative act. It must be applied in its entirety across the EU. For example, when the European Commission wanted to make sure that the caps on interchange were set in the same way for all the 27 member states, they used, indeed, the instrument of a regulation. And we add the interchange regulation, the multilateral interchange fee regulation. A directive, on the other side, is a legislative act that sets out a goal that all EU countries must then achieve. However, it's then up to the individual countries to devise their own laws on how to reach these goals. So there is more flexibility allowed. Examples are the sake of our discussion here on payment services regulation, the PSD1 and PSD2, which are indeed directives. So the directive is a more flexible instrument that allows more flexibility to the member states in, let's say, adopting the principles that the European Commission is dictating them.
So while we're talking about the EU here, I will also be discussing other regulatory bodies from around the world. And frankly, not all the regulators are the same. They have different goals and different ways of operating. For instance, many regulatory works are implemented for changing the payment industry for the benefit of society that they serve. Well, that may sound obvious, but it's not necessarily so. So, for instance, when the UK started on the NPA, its original design goals were based upon what are the detriments of society and what are the things that we need to do to help citizens, corporates, organizations, various stakeholders meet those goals. Whereas some other regulators are more focused in on the technical requirements of the industry, for instance, the USA. So while we're talking about regulation, there are very different ways of thinking about it. Broadly speaking, there are interventionist regulators who come in and say, this is what we want to do, this is why we want to do it, and our society will be better for it. And there are technical regulators who are saying, that's a commercial decision, that's a business world. I just want to make sure that the payment rails work. And clearly, they're very different ways of going about it. So this is our first podcast, and hopefully we'll set out what we're trying to do and perhaps what are the complexities that we're trying to navigate into a, you know, a smaller bite-sized chunk. We would really love to get your feedback. So please do ping us and let us know what your thoughts are and the topics that you would like us to explore. So let's just have a little quick advert about what the next podcast will be about. Well, probably the most famous directive is of course, PSD2. So as an example of the regulatory work, we're going to discuss how we got to PSD, PSD amendment, PSD2, and of course, the possible content of what will be in PSD3. So just to give us some bite-sized chunks, Monica, what are the possible highlights of what we should expect in PSD3?
Oh, well, Paul, thank you for the question. This is a very interesting question. What we understand is, you know, when you look at the story of PSD1 and PSD2, well, PSD1 was about creating really a license for payment institutions, but also creating a legal framework for payments, which would cover many aspects of the payment chain. From a regulatory perspective, this was the first time something like that happened. And then PSD2 was creating the license for third-party payments providers and also the strong customer authentication procedure. PSD3 is likely to work further on the strong customer authentication procedure, maybe simplifying it or proposing different ways to in fact, do a strong customer authentication. The scope of PSD2 is likely also to be reviewed. There is a lot of discussion about technical service providers, for example, whether they should be in scope of PSD3, while for the moment they're out of scope via Article 3J of PSD2. There is a lot of discussion about also whether PSD3 will create a new license. As I was saying, PSD1 was creating a license for payment institutions, PSD2 was creating a license for third-party payments providers. Maybe PSD3 will create a license for another type of actor. I don't know, fintechs or maybe a license for technical services providers. We do not know. It's certain that this is going to be coherent with the first two pieces of law. And another trend that I've been observing is that the scope is always increasing and the exemptions from the scope are shrinking from one version to the other of the directive. So I expect the same situation here. I expect the scope to comprehend more activities and more services than it's currently the case for the PSD2. And I also expect the exemptions from the scope to be somehow reduced. For the strong customer authentication, maybe a link to the e-wallet or some form of user wallet for e-identity wallet for the strong customer authentication. But yeah, it's still early day to say.
Yeah. It is. And thank you for that, Monica. So, during the next podcast, we'll also discuss the retail payment strategy. And as part of that work, I interviewed one of the European Commission's representatives in charge of the retail payment strategy, Mrs. Xiao Pereira, and we discussed its scope. That video is on the Finastra website, so please search Finastra and regulation. I will also put a link into the video interview that I did. And I think that'll put into context a lot of the things that we also start to talk about. So please do give us your feedback, and I really look forward to seeing you soon. As I say, this is the first, but thanks for listening to Bite-Sized Payments Regulation with Monica and myself. Thank you.
Thank you.